When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Academic Life, a podcast for your academic journey and beyond. I'm the show's producer and the show host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today we'll be talking about the new book, Contingent Faculty and the Remaking of Higher Education. Contingent Faculty and the Remaking of Higher Education is an essay collection co-edited by Eric Fuhrer Slocum and Claire Goldstein. It explores why in the United States more than three-quarters of the people teaching in colleges and universities work as contingent faculty. This gig economy includes lack of job security and healthcare, professional disrespect, and poverty wages that can require some faculty to juggle multiple jobs. The included essays draw on a wide range of perspectives, investigate structural changes that have caused the use of contingent faculty to skyrocket, illuminate how precarity shapes day-to-day experiences in the academic workplace, and delve into the ways contingent faculty engage in collective action and other means to resist austerity measures, improve their working conditions, and instigate reforms in higher education. By challenging contingency, this volume issues a call to reclaim higher education's public purpose. I'm joined by the co-editor, Dr. Claire Goldstein, and by a contributing essayist, Maria Maisto. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
I am so glad that you're both here and that we're going to talk about this book and how it came to be. Before we dive into that, though, will you please tell us about yourself? Maria, can we start with you?
Sure. First of all, thanks for inviting me to do this. I'm really thrilled to be here. My journey in higher ed, I think, was a pretty smooth one, straight from undergraduate through graduate school. I've been in higher ed for all of my adult life in one capacity or another. I went into graduate school hoping to become a professor because I loved education. And my journey was derailed when I could not complete my PhD. I wrote one chapter of my dissertation, had my first child, then had another child. And this was back in the days when having children could often derail women's ability to finish. So I accepted the fact that I did not complete it and went on with my life. But when I had the opportunity to teach as an adjunct faculty member, I jumped on it. We had moved to Ohio. And it was that experience as an adjunct faculty member that really opened up my eyes to a whole side of higher education that I had been completely ignorant about in all of my previous exposure as a graduate student. And also, I should mention, I worked at a couple of higher ed associations. So it was that experience that caused me to go into some form of activism. Eventually, I co-founded New Faculty Majority, which was the first national nonprofit association to try and address the problem of contingent faculty. Did that for about a decade. Family responsibilities required me to step away from that. And now I am an academic staffer. So I'm still working in higher ed and still learning about higher ed.
Thank you. Claire, will you please tell us about yourself?
Sure. I think my journey is a little bit different than Maria's. I definitely did not go straight through. I took breaks at various points on my educational journey. So came back to graduate school to pursue a history PhD as a somewhat older student. I graduated and did what many people do, which was try to find a teaching job, which was not easy. I had a number of one-year positions at different institutions and found myself in a five-year period moving back and forth across the country four different times. And at a certain point, I determined that I was just too old to continue to pack up my stuff. And in addition, just the anxiety of not knowing from year to year where I was going to live or if I was going to have a job, if I was going to have health benefits. So at a certain point, I made the decision to return from the East Coast back to California, which is where I am from originally. And I now do not work in the academic world in my day job, but it comes with exciting things like health benefits and retirement benefits. But through that, continued to be very active around contingent faculty organizing. I continued to write on these issues, support unionization efforts. And I also continued to pursue my own scholarship. That was really important to me, that even though I was no longer in an academic teaching position, I wanted to remain intellectually engaged with my field. So I did get my first book out, and I'm continuing to research a second book in addition to this co-edited volume, which I worked on with Eric Fuhrer Slocum.
And that leads to this co-edited volume. It's called Contingent Faculty and the Remaking of Higher Education, a Labor History. In the introduction and threaded a bit throughout the book, it explains how this book came to be. But for listeners, can you tell us?
Sure, happy to. So Eric and I met through our activism. The Labor and Working Class History Association had a committee on contingent faculty that was primarily focused on advocacy within that professional association to represent the interests of a growing segment of the field, but not necessarily of the organization's membership. So it was through our work with the committee that Eric and I started talking about the idea for this book. And it was a combination, I guess it would be more appropriate, of our activism and work with that committee, as well as our own experiences as contingent faculty. Eric's a longtime contingent faculty member. And that was part of an effort to place what was happening to us and our own work experience in a larger context. And since he and I were both trained as labor historians, we were also trying to understand it in that context, that this is ultimately a labor relationship. Academics don't often like to think of themselves as workers. But when you use that lens to look at this as an employer-employee relationship, it really brings the power dynamics to the fore. And there's also a history here. And so the goal with the book was to try to reflect that while also taking into account people's personal experiences with contingency, and also talking about what's being done in the current moment to organize around these issues in an effort to change them.
And Eric wrote one of the opening chapters where he takes us through about the last 40 years and shows this dramatic shift from campuses being 75-80% tenured faculty to it flipped to where being tenured faculty is the minority and the supermajority is people who are contingent faculty. Before we go too much further, can we start defining some terms for listener? When we say contingent faculty, what is it that we mean?
That is a really good question. And the answer is probably more complicated than it might first appear on the surface. One of the ongoing conversations in contingent activism has been about definitions and terms. So generally, for the purposes of the book, contingent faculty is anybody who is not tenured or tenure track. And that covers a range. Broadly, it covers adjuncts, people who are hired and paid per course. It also includes people who are hired on one or multi-year contracts, but have no expectation of moving into a tenure track position. It also, there are chapters in the book on graduate students. Contingent faculty can also include postdocs, visiting scholars. There are a range of titles, but the broadly, I would say it's people who have insecure employment and who lack the protections, both the economic, but equally important, the academic freedom protections of tenure.
One of the things that I've noticed is that contingency is kind of hidden in plain sight. I'm wondering if either of you were aware if any of your own professors who taught you as an undergrad or a graduate student were contingent faculty.
I'd love to jump in on that one, because one of the gifts, I think, of the work that we did was this ability to reflect on our own education and to understand a little bit better how contingent faculty played roles in our own lives. And so when I looked back on my undergraduate experience, I realized that two or three of the professors that I most admired and the ones who were most helpful to me were contingent faculty. And I had no idea at the time. And so that really informed my determination to make educating students a huge part of the work that we were trying to do in New Faculty Majority and in any kind of activism that I engaged in personally. So I think that that's a really, really insightful question, and I really thank you for asking it.
Were you aware at the time of any, and you know, we're thinking of hindsight now because all of us are you know, done with pursuing our higher ed degrees, but when you were a student, did you notice things like, huh, this person is sharing an office, or when I meet with this person, they always say, let's go meet at the campus cafe, or let's sit outside on a bench. Did you notice any differences that at the time didn't strike you as being signs that they were contingent, but they definitely were having to inhabit campus spaces differently than your other professors?
For me, yes. I remember I had an economics professor who I was struggling a little bit in the class. I was a freshman, first year student, and I was struggling a little bit. And at the time, I'm dating myself a little bit here, there were not a lot of women in the class. And she was a woman, and she noticed that I was struggling. And so she reached out to me and she said, why don't you come see me and let me see if I can help you a little bit. So I was very grateful for that. I went to meet her, and no, there was no office. We had to sit in, I remember very distinctly sitting on a couch in the department office while she went over the material with me. And I remember thinking at the time, this is a little bit odd, but I didn't ask any questions at the time. So, and then another professor was very supportive of the work that I was doing actually in history. And I really wanted to follow up with him, and I could not find him. And to this day, I cannot find him. I would love to find him. I don't know where he went.
Claire, does this bring back any memories for you?
I would say that my experience as a student is a little bit different than what Maria described. I think in part because my father was a college professor and my undergraduate and master's degrees were from the same institution where he taught. So I think it was probably a little bit unusual in going into that experience with some understanding of the fact that there were contingent faculty teaching the course, some of the courses that I was taking, but I knew that. But my guess is that I was one of the few people who knew it. And I only knew it because of conversations with my father. Nothing that was happening on campus or in the classroom would have given me a clue that that was the case.
With your family having a history of being professors, did it dawn on you that you might end up in one of those contingent roles, or did you think you were going to land something tenure track?
I think the honest answer to that question is a little bit of both. So on the one hand, I think I did have a concern whether or not I was going to end up with a tenure track job, which ultimately when I went through graduate school was my goal. On the other hand, I think because I had come back to school, having worked for quite a number of years outside of the academic world, I also came to it with a secondary goal, which was I really wanted to write about equal opportunity, which is what I ended up doing my dissertation and my first book about. So I had both of those goals at the same time, trying to get a teaching job, but also trying to work on this book. So while I was hugely disappointed that I didn't get a tenure track job, I also remained very committed to finishing the book regardless. So I think it was a little bit of a bundle of contradictions.
The book takes us through so many things about contingent faculty. It has 20 chapters. And Maria, your chapter is chapter 12, Common Ground for the Common Good. What we hear when we say faculty working conditions are student learning conditions. Can you tell us about your chapter and what inspired you to write it?
Sure. I'd love to talk about this because when Claire, who I knew from having worked with her in New Faculty Majority, when she contacted me to ask if I would do this, I had sort of stepped away from the activism for a little bit. And I was a little bit reluctant, partly because I'd been away. But she told me that they were hoping that I would focus on students. And I really loved that idea. And so when I thought about it, I thought, well, you know, this is an opportunity to focus on students because that was really the reason, part of the reason that I got into it in the first place. My experience in as teaching as a contingent faculty member, one of the things that pushed me into activism was seeing very, very starkly how my working conditions were affecting my students, and knowing that it wasn't my fault that I wasn't available, that I was trying to have some kind of work-life balance with young kids, but I was also, there were also huge demands on my time in order to teach these students. And I felt very strongly that I had an ethical obligation to make myself available to these students. So that tension really helped propel me into activism. And when I got into the activism, I started to learn a little bit about the history of contingent faculty activism, which is most people don't realize it's decades old. But the slogan or the saying, faculty working conditions are student learning conditions, was really a foundational principle for the movement. I think it was coined in a faculty union. I don't think we know exactly who came up with it, but it became the foundational principle for our work at NFM because we realized that, we were not a union. We were trying to be an advocacy organization. And if we needed to communicate with the public, we had to help the public understand that this advocacy was designed to help everyone benefit from education as a whole. So So when we got started, you know, we thought it was pretty self-evident, faculty working conditions are student learning conditions. If faculty aren't compensated well and don't have support, then it's going to have an effect on students. But it's not as simple as it sounds. And over the course of the decade that at least I was really actively involved, I observed a lot of tensions, sometimes seeming contradictions, sometimes interesting connections that came out of the concepts of faculty, students, working conditions, learning conditions. And since I was trained in rhetorical analysis, and I have a tendency perhaps to overanalyze, but because I liked the idea of doing a close reading of that slogan, of that saying, that's what I decided to do the chapter on. And it was an attempt to sort of examine the principle, the concept, and to think a little bit about what we could learn from it. So I think that's kind of a general, I hope that's a good enough general explanation of what I was trying to do.
You said you're interested in what we can learn from it. Do you have some takeaways for listeners of what we can learn from it?
Yeah, absolutely. So one big concept Claire has already referred to, and that is the idea that faculty work is work. One of the things that we learned in doing our activism was that faculty have a tendency to think of themselves as professionals, which they are, but that concept of being a professional and professionalism is often divorced from the idea of work and of labor. And so that was absolutely one of the key concepts that came out of the work and of really reflecting on this general principle. So that was really, really important. And then, you know, the idea of who the faculty are. Faculty, you know, we just talked about who are contingent faculty. But faculty include our colleagues in K-12 education, and we don't often think about them. Faculty may not technically include our colleagues who work on campuses as academic staffers, but I can tell you that quite a number of academic staffers that I have met are people who, like me, had hoped to become a faculty member. So, and I remember talking to someone who said, every person who works at a university or a college or a university is a teacher in some form or another. So sort of thinking about the concept of faculty in a more expansive way was one. Thinking about the concept of learning conditions. What does it mean to learn? Is it how has the concept of learning evolved over time? And how has the impact of sort of a consumerist attitude toward education, how has that affected how students see themselves, how they see the work of learning? And how has that affected our activism? So all of those contradictions and relationships were really important to me to explore.
The consumerism, the business model, is something that comes through in your chapter, Claire. You have the final chapter of the book where you take us through some of the effects on the faculty who are contingent, some of the professional losses they face, some of the things that we've already touched on about how hard it can be for students to stay in touch with them. But you also encourage us to look at shifting employment patterns and to see how sort of this idea of being consumers of education has affected how education is delivered. Do you want to take us inside your chapter and the takeaways you hope listeners will take from it?
Sure. Happy to do that. I think I might back up a little bit. I think that there's an important word that hasn't come up yet, but it does come up frequently in these conversations, and it's meritocracy. So the university, things that are happening on college campuses in so many ways are no different than what's happening in any other workplace. And these colleges and universities are just very much a product of the society in which they're situated. So my chapter really came out of a certain amount of self-reflection as I was moving back and forth across the country in pursuit of work. I really started to wonder, what is happening to me? Why is this happening to me? And trying to figure out if this was something that I was responsible for. Was there something I had done wrong? Was there something that I could have done differently? And I think that's a feeling that's shared by a lot of people who find themselves as contingent faculty. I think there's a degree of self-blame, and that is shrouded or connected to this idea that the people who do end up with tenured positions are the people who deserve them. And that goes back to a point you made earlier, Christina, which is the shrinking number of tenure track jobs and the greater numbers of people who are applying for them. And so as part of my effort to understand what was happening to me, that's when I really started to take a step back and look at this broader context of what is going on here. And when you have a situation where you have upwards of 75% of the faculty who lack the protections of tenure, for me personally, and I might add, this is not a view that's necessarily shared by everybody who contributed to the book, which is something I'm actually really pleased about. There is not a monolithic voice in the book. People have different perspectives. But for me personally, that is something that really caught my attention. What happens when such a small percentage of faculty are the only ones with the protections of academic freedom? What does that do to the people who are standing up in front of a group of students trying to teach? And how does that affect what you teach and what you don't teach, how you teach it, how you choose not to teach it, what you're asking students to read and write about? When your economic livelihood is at stake, when something you say in the classroom could jeopardize your return to work, it's not unreasonable to think that that might change how you approach what's happening in the classroom. And that really got me to thinking about what is the loss, because ultimately this amounts to a loss of tenure and the protections of tenure for academic freedom. And I would add, not just for contingent faculty, this also weakens academic freedom protections for all faculty, because in total, this what's happening with faculty reduces the power of all faculty on campus, including those who are tenured. And I think that that really affects what's happening inside the classroom. And that has very real consequences then for the students who are in those classrooms and the type of education that they receive. And I think it's it tends to support a kind of education that is, I think, not as beneficial to these students as might otherwise be the case. I do want to say too, though, that as Maria sort of mentioned, that some of the faculty that she felt most connected to as an undergraduate were contingent faculty. Contingent faculty are amazing teachers and they're incredibly dedicated. But broadly, the conditions under which they work make it really difficult for them to do their job well, which is to challenge students, to get them to challenge conventional wisdom, to ask hard questions, to have difficult conversations in the classroom. That becomes really difficult to do if you're afraid that a negative student evaluation is going to prevent you from being rehired the next term.
I notice we're using the term tenure quite a bit, and I wonder if we could just take a minute to explicitly define tenure and what it is that faculty hope they'll get by getting tenure, because I think it's a word that's used so much, but I think maybe not all listeners know what sort of protections faculty hope they'll be guaranteed if they get tenure.
So I think that in general terms, tenure provides greater job security. So in most academic departments, if you're on the tenure track, you're on the tenure track for a certain number of years. There's an evaluation of your teaching, possibly your scholarship, depending where you are. And then it's a promotion into the tenured ranks. And it affords you a higher degree of due process if there's any sort of action taken against you. And so it offers you that kind of protection, and it offers you greater economic security with an expectation that you will be coming back the next semester or the next year to teach, which is something that most contingent faculty don't have.
Can I jump in here for a second and just add to what Claire is saying? One of the things that I found really interesting about the work that we did was the realization that even tenure track faculty have lost touch with what tenure was originally intended for in terms of its connection to the common good, because the idea of tenure and the need for academic freedom and security so that we can have these kinds of conversations in the classroom are in order to advance an understanding of the common good. That was sort of the historical understanding of what a professional is supposed to do. So medical professionals work for the common good, legal professionals work for the common good, and educational professionals work for the common good. And somewhere along the line, tenure transformed into something that was very individualized, that was an aspiration for individual faculty members to achieve personal job security. And somewhere along the line, this notion of a responsibility to the common good was lost. And the rise of contingency, I think, is an absolute reflection of that, and is one of the reasons that tenure is being attacked. So I think that's an important development that we have to recognize, and it's similar to the way that that the idea of teaching serving students, so this the slogan faculty working conditions are student learning conditions, was designed to sort of make people understand that faculty can't serve students if their own working conditions are substandard, but the idea of service sort of transformed into a notion of sacrifice that is really not what the service of teaching is supposed to be. So the transformations of these concepts, I think, can't be discounted in terms of their effect in terms of their real world effects.
And if I can just follow up on that, I think that's so important, because a number of the essays in the book really argue about returning to education for a common good and what is the public purpose of education. And a number of the chapters talk, it raises the question of what is the primary purpose of a university and a college, and where does the education mission fit in with that when it's competing against athletics, the growing ranks of administrators, all kinds of other things, real estate transactions, all kinds of other things that seem to be more important on college and university campuses than the actual teaching mission that Maria was talking about.
One of the things that surprises me is that students and family members who may be helping support the cost of going to school for them seem still fairly unaware of how monies are spent on campus. When things moved online during the early years of the pandemic, and faculty were now teaching their classes solely online, there was no campus presence really, a number of people reached out to me and said, well, do you think tuition costs is going to drop? Because, you know, what are we paying for now? And I was trying to explain that you can't really cut the tuition costs because the professors are barely making a salary as it is. And having the professor deliver their content online to the student is as labor intensive as when they were in the classroom. This sudden pivot is hugely labor intensive. So it seems that if we consider that, some of the essays talk about how we've kind of moved to a business model and a consumer model of education, that if we take students and the family who help fund them going, as our consumers, they don't understand really where tuition money goes and how there's even a disparity of how faculty in the same department are paid, meaning contingent faculty are paid very differently than someone who's tenure track and then someone who's tenured. Is there anything about that you'd like to highlight for listeners?
I can answer that first and Maria can add to it. I think so that question raises so many things in my mind. I think it raises the fact that students are incredible allies, I think, of contingent faculty and contingent faculty organizing. Students and professors, students and teachers often really do have a special relationship. And in my experience, when students learn about the working conditions and the pay of the majority of the people who are teaching them, they're really shocked and upset and outraged. Not only that question of where are my tuition dollars going, but it's not what they imagine. It's not what they imagine for the person who's teaching them, for their professor. I think that for contingent faculty to share that information with their students is incredibly powerful, but also incredibly difficult because it can be very embarrassing and very shameful. And I think that goes back to that question of meritocracy. Mm-hmm. I went to school. Most people who are teaching as contingent faculty have some advanced degree or multiple advanced degrees. And it's embarrassing to get up in front of your students and say, I'm being paid $2,500 this semester to teach this class. That can be really difficult for people to do, but I think it's so vitally important for the movement. And a number of the essays in the book talk about various organizing efforts among faculty. And these issues come up quite a bit about how do we get the word out to parents and students about what's going on. And one of the most important things is to hide and not to feel shame about this, that this is something much larger. This is not a reflection of a personal failure, and this is nothing to be embarrassed about. This is something to organize about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the most powerful things that we can do as activists is figure out ways to get students involved. And rather than sitting around thinking, okay, well, how can we get students involved? We have to learn from students. We have to talk to them. And in addition to revealing these things in our classrooms, one of the things that we can do is look at what students are experiencing. Students themselves are often working. I taught at a community college, and students, their work schedules were incredible. And that was often the primary obstacle to their being able to really engage with their work. And so they taught me as much as I think I taught them. And I can give you a perfect example. When I moved from teaching at a university to teaching at a community college, it was at a time when my husband had just lost his job. It was during the Great Recession, and we were in a really precarious situation. And somehow I was doing the contingent thing and teaching at multiple campuses, one at a university and one at a community college. And the community college called me and said, we have a full-time non-tenure track teaching job opening up for the year. Would you be willing to take it? Because someone had to leave. And I often think about that poor person and why they had to leave and what happened to them. And I said, absolutely, yes, because it was going to get me health insurance for my family. But I had to go back to the students that I was teaching at the university halfway through the semester and say, I have to leave. I'm sorry. And I felt really guilty about it. I even wrote them a letter explaining why I had to do it. And I used that as my opportunity to explain to them sort of the structural conditions that were forcing me to do this. And I was sort of blown away by the level of support that I got from them. And I realized that as much as the system tries to force students into a consumerist stance, the students themselves are resisting it, because they came to me and they said, you should absolutely take that job. Do not apologize. Don't worry about us. By the way, are you going to unionize? You know, that kind of thing. And it was so instructive to me. And it made me really appreciate again why I love teaching. And that is that you learn as much from the students as the students learn from you.
One of the things we wanted to make time for before we sign off today is what we can learn from the activism, from naming what these conditions are, from naming what we need to change. It can leave us feeling a bit helpless. But you want there to be hope, and you want us to know there are things we can learn and we can take some next steps to propel activity towards a better outcome. In the time we have left, what would you like to share with listeners about that?
So I can, I'm happy to start on that. I think that one of the things to know is that union organizing among contingent faculty, even prior to the pandemic, was one of the largest growth sectors for unionization in the country. The pandemic really accelerated that, and accelerated that in other industries as well. But I think it is worth noting that, as Maria said earlier, activism and organizing and unionization around contingent faculty has been going on for a really long time. I think what's very exciting now and different now is there is a lot of other organizing going on campuses as well. Student workers are organizing, graduate students are organizing, postdocs are organizing, and there is an increasing effort to organize together, to support one another, to find a commonality of concern and interest among all campus workers, and to embrace that model of industrial unionism and to support one another in labor actions. So I think that those are really important developments in the last number of years that are bringing a lot of energy to the organizing around contingent faculty.
I absolutely agree. I think that some of the new organizing that is happening is some of the most exciting that I've seen in a long time, because it is expansive and it is inclusive. It's looking at the campus as a whole rather than looking at sectors of workers within the campus, and it is really promoting the idea of solidarity. So that expansiveness, I think, is one really important idea that is sort of animating the activity that's taking place right now. The other one is that, in addition to sort of expanding the concept or the idea of who is doing the work, it's also expanding the idea of what that work is. And I refer in my chapter to bargaining for the common good, which is an effort within unions and among unions to focus bargaining efforts not just on the needs of the workers who are engaged in bargaining, but to have a sense of how they can also advocate for the community as a whole. So it's using worker power for the common good. And I think that that's a really, really important idea that has to be promoted. And then finally, I always go back to education. As a parent, I have been sort of surprised and dismayed at how little labor education happens in this country at all levels. So I think we need to really focus on having more labor education at all levels of from K-12 and on into higher ed. We don't have enough labor studies programs. And I think that I think it's possible that maybe students are going to start demanding it, and I will be right there with them.
Claire, one of the points that you make is that this isn't just a book about contingent faculty. This isn't myopic. What affects contingent faculty affects higher ed, and it affects beyond higher ed. Do you want to take a couple minutes to talk about how this isn't, there isn't this divide that we sometimes hear about, there's what's going on campus and then there's the real world, that what's happening here is absolutely part of the real world?
Sure, I'm happy to do that. And I try to talk about those issues in my chapter. I think there is this sort of mythology that universities, we use the phrase the ivory tower, that somehow they're disconnected, separate from, and occupying this different realm. And I think that all you have to do is learn the most basic things about the contingent faculty working conditions. As you pointed out earlier, right? Not having an office, not knowing if you're going to be teaching next semester, being grossly underpaid for your work, running from campus to teach, having very little time for your students. That's just at the most basic level. Those are very real world economic pressures. So those things are always present. But in addition to that, I am particularly concerned about the effects of the reality of those working conditions on what's happening in the classroom and the particular politics that are attached to that. And what I mean by that is that I think that an education that encourages students to challenge what they know, that presents to students a perspective that's new and different, and that often flips what they think they understand on its head, encourages them to think. That kind of education is inherently progressive, not progressive in a partisan sense on a particular issue, but it is embedded in a history of how we explore knowledge in a way that says truth is not static, our understanding is not static, our understanding of things continues to evolve, and build on prior knowledge, that method of teaching, that way of teaching, is inherently a threat to the status quo. So that if you put limits on education, if you put limits on what people can and or do and do not feel comfortable saying in a classroom, I think that has very real political consequences. In the most recent sort of obvious example, the 1960s and 70s, universities were really important sites for political protest, for introducing new ways of thinking. Whole new fields of study emerged out of the activism of the 60s and 70s. When you create an environment where the vast majority of faculty are concerned about whether they say something in the classroom that's going to jeopardize their employment, you're really reducing the likelihood that innovative new ways of thinking, new ideas, challenges to conventional wisdom are going to come out of higher education. And I think that has real political consequences, and it is detrimental to society at large. And it diminishes what Maria was talking about the common good and public purpose of education.
One of the things that comes through in the book is that we don't have too many PhDs graduating. We have this severe contracture of tenure lines, and we have reductions of entire departments. We have this remaking of how jobs are held on campus and how you get them. And one thing you have emphasized is that it's not a meritocracy. It's a bit more of a lottery. And yet, one thing that comes through in the book and when we were talking off air is that we all like higher ed. We all are excited about learning, research, knowledge, teaching, so many great things that happen on campus. Maria, you have your staff job, and Claire, you're writing and releasing your books. I think between the three of us, we still have great hope for everything that education is and can continue to be. As we start to wind down the episode, I want to ask you each what you hope this episode will spark for listeners. Maria, can we start with you?
Well, I really, really hope people read the book. And it's not just to plug the book. I think what's so wonderful about it is that it's going to help spark conversations, really, really important conversations, because it provides history. It provides different perspectives on really important issues that we really didn't even get into in this conversation about ableism and ageism and misogyny and racism and the effects of this structural problem on those issues and how it exacerbates the injustices that we see. So I really, really hope that that people will start to talk more, think more, and get together and start figuring out creatively what we can do to continue to work against these structural limitations. I'm sure that there are new ways that are going to come out of these conversations, because there are so many new activists coming into the movement that really, really give me hope, because there's a little bit of burnout that happens in activism. And for me, seeing the new generation of activists is really, really inspiring.
And for listeners who want to be pointed to where there's more in the book, specifically on talking back against ableism, ageism, and contingency, chapter 10 is focused on that. And it is also, those themes are discussed in other chapters as well. Claire, same question for you.
Sure. So I think that when Eric and I sat down many, many, what feels like even many more years ago, to talk through this book and what we had hoped to achieve, I think we both really did approach it as scholar activists, and we really wanted the book to reflect that. And not to repeat what Maria said, but I think my elevator pitch for the book is essentially the book attempts to explain how we got here, what here looks like, and how do we get out of here. And I think that each of the main three sections speak to those themes and provide that context. And I think that overall, the book is really trying to situate the efforts to organize in a historical context with the goal of making that organizing more effective, to understand what it is you're organizing against so that you can organize in response to the reality of those conditions. And I think that Eric and I are both really hopeful that the book, as Maria said, sparks conversations, helps in some small way to move forward organizing efforts. And I think as well, if it is able to do that, it is really a testament to all of the people who contributed chapters to the book. I think I've said this in other places. At a certain point when Eric and I were reading through some of the drafts of the initial submissions of the chapters, I just was really struck by how smart so many of the contributors' essays were and how those essays really reflected people who had thought really smartly and deeply and long about these issues. And I hope that that then is some service to this larger movement to try to improve higher education and remake it in a different way than it has been remade over the past number of decades.
There is so much more in the book, and I wish we had another hour to dive into more of the chapters. I'm thankful for the time that we had today. And for listeners who want to specifically start looking at Pass Forward, that's the final section of the book. Thank you both so much for being here today, Maria Maisto and Claire Goldstein, and taking us inside the new book, Contingent Faculty and the Remaking of Higher Education. This is The Academic Life. Please join us again.